Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From one of those spacious second floor offices on 16 West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi, glad to have you along as always. Today, your guest is the Rules Chairman of the North Carolina House, a Republican from Harnett County, Representative David Lewis. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be with you today.
Let's start with voter ID. That is something, voter ID as it pertains to university ID. Give us the latest. You and I are recording this on a Wednesday afternoon. Where do things stand in 30 to 60 seconds with university ID being admissible or not admissible during the next election?
Important to understand that with the bill that we passed today, voter ID will not be required in 2019. So any issues that need to be resolved are able to be fully resolved. As it pertains to universities, we believe that nearly all of the universities have the information they need in order to be able to comply. There are a couple of them that have a few outstanding concerns, namely with how the picture is taken, and we have committed to working with them, and we have until 2020 to get this resolved, and we will.
What about this question of citizenship? In order to vote, you have to be a U.S. citizen, obviously. And the UNC system doesn't verify citizenship with their IDs, or do they? Is citizenship the long-term issue here?
I know the university's misunderstood. It is not their responsibility to verify citizenship. It is a responsibility of the Board of Elections. So you've got the Board of Elections who's responsible for registering people to vote. The only component of the voting process the university has anything to do with is if they issue an ID with a picture and the picture matches the person. That is the final step in the process. In no way are they required to verify citizenship or do anything different than they normally do when they register people for their classes.
We're going to take through a couple of newsy items here. Things that are happening at the legislature this week or happening here in the North Carolina political scene. Our state Supreme Court is back to seven justices. The judicial musical chairs, if you will, started last month. Mark Martin went to be dean of the Regent School, Law School in Virginia. Sherry Beasley elevated to fill that chief justice role. Governor took plenty of criticism for going against what has been precedent and practice of elevating the most experienced member of that bench. And then this week, we found out, I think it was after perhaps 4 or 5 weeks, Sherry Beasley was elevated, that Mark Davis, Court of Appeals judge since 2013, is the newest justice on the state Supreme Court. You weren't surprised with the selection of Davis. I know that. Or you weren't surprised that it was a Democrat. Was this a particularly controversial pick, or is this actually a pretty mundane pick that perhaps there's some amped up rhetoric surrounding?
Obviously, as a Republican, I would have preferred a Republican be picked. But I'm also a realist. The governor is a Democrat. He selected two Democrats for the vacant positions on the court, and that was certainly his right to do so. I do think it's particularly interesting that many of the good government groups that frequently talk about the court should be nonpartisan and they should get politics out of the courts are all crowing now that the Democrats have such a lopsided majority on the court and are actually making predictions about what the court is going to do. I don't think the legislature, or at least the Republicans, have been so bold as to do that yet. So, no, I don't criticize the governor for his picks. He is the governor and has the responsibility to fill those vacancies. We had asked the people if they wanted a different way to fill vacancies, and those amendments to the Constitution didn't pass.
If you were governor, you've never run for statewide office, if you were governor, would you have followed the same party protocol that he did here? If you were a Republican governor and the Democratic Chief Justice resigned or announced his or her retirement somewhat abruptly, would you have put two Republicans in those vacancies?
If I were governor, I would have probably supported a different process, similar to the one the General Assembly put on the ballot, where a commission would vet names and then I could pick from those names. I think you get a better representation of someone who's truly qualified to serve. But if I were playing with the exact same rules that Governor Cooper was playing with, frankly, I would have probably picked two Republicans.
Supreme Court, seven justices, is now comprised of six Democrats and a Republican. Just 30 months ago, I mean, just a little bit more than 2 years ago, it was a 4-3 Republican court. So the Democrats have a significant advantage there. At the Court of Appeals level, presently it's 8-7, Republicans to Democrats, based on Davis coming from the Court of Appeals up to the Supreme Court, and based on a mandatory retirement that's coming at the Court of Appeals later this month, because in the state of North Carolina, you have to retire when you're 72. There are going to be two vacancies on the Court of Appeals. There's already one, as soon as Davis moves up, and there will be a second one soon. If, presuming the governor appoints two Democrats, that will then be an 8-7 Democrat court. How significant, and you alluded to this a moment ago, so I want to get into, you know, some of what these changes mean, but how significant is it really from your vantage point that the Supreme Court is now firmly Democratic and the Court of Appeals is now going to have very soon, we presume, a narrow Democratic majority?
I think the most significant thing is going to be in 2020. You're going to have three seats on the North Carolina Supreme Court that are all going to be up for election. I think we are looking at a $30 or $40 million campaign for the Supreme Court. And I think it's the most dangerous thing we've ever really faced politically in the state, because the predictions of the politicization of the court, it is going to be now. The stakes are so high. You know, we are a nation of laws. What the courts say ultimately rules. So if you want to control the process, then you have to win in the courts. And I think you're going to see more spending on the Supreme Court in 2020 than you have seen in the past 10 years combined.
You've been around elections a long time. Do you think that spending is really going to make a difference? Or do you think that the top of the ticket in 2020, however Donald Trump, presuming the president is on the ticket in 2020, however he does, is ultimately going to decide or influence greatly those three judicial races?
Obviously, the top of the ticket influences things like turnout. But I have always believed and continue to believe that people usually look favorably upon Republican jurists when they offer themselves for the court. And so I don't believe necessarily that the top of the ticket influences the bottom of the ticket, or in this case, what's usually the back of the ballot. So, you know, that's we've took a little bit of criticism for making the races partisan again. I would say that we did not make the races partisan. We simply identified plainly what the politics of the nominees are. For years, we had no political affiliations by the candidate's name, but both of the major political parties would endorse people and spend money on them. So the races were partisan without the partisan label. A lot of the research that I've done and we've presented publicly in committee shows what I call a drop-off in participation of voting and for the judges, and I think that's largely been because people don't know anything about the judges. I mean, I'm from Harnett County, but I'm sure it's the same in Johnston and Wake and Durham and everywhere else. The Democrats stand outside the polls and the Republicans stand outside the polls and hand out ballot cards, and every Democrat is marked on the Democratic ballot and every Republican's marked on the Republican ballot, and you can be sure there's a name by every judge, but not everybody takes one of those things. And so In fact, I can remember the last time we had a race for Chief Justice, I think what I call the drop-off was almost 30%. So people just, you know, roughly a third of the people just didn't vote for the judges at all because they didn't know anything about them. They didn't recognize their name. And so I think that adding the partisan label to what has always been a partisan contest without the label, it makes more sense. It gives the voter more information.
A little bit of context, and I only know this because I looked at it, I think, last night. Mark Davis, who, again, was just appointed to Associate Justice of the High Court, ran for the Court of Appeals in 2014, and there was about a 22% drop-off. Total votes for the Tillis-Hagen race, the U.S. Senate race in 2014, compared to that Court of Appeals race, there was a significant drop-off. Now, we should also note that this past year, when there were these constitutional referenda or proposed constitutional referenda on the ballot, there was, if I'm recalling correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong, it was like a minuscule drop-off. It was like 2 or 3%, which is not the norm, right? That's not the norm. Okay. You alluded to the role that this Supreme Court may play in redistricting, gerrymandering over the next year, year and a half. Are you confident that, I mean, Mark Davis, to be fair, has been a judge for 6 years. I don't think you've ever issued a press release or offered any criticism of Mark Davis. Tell me if I'm mistaken here. Stop me at any point. You're shaking your head. No, you have not. Are you confident that as these redistricting lawsuits, there's specifically one we're getting into now, Common Cause is the plaintiff. Are you confident that the state Supreme Court is going to give you all a fair shake over the next year and a half?
I would be very surprised if Justice Earls, who has been the lead litigant in suing over the redistricting plans, and frankly, Justice Morgan, who's given speeches criticizing the redistricting plan, would find it ethically suitable for them to participate in the deliberation of these cases. That being said, I believe that the maps that we have passed are constitutional, and I'm not afraid of our day in court.
Representative David Lewis is the guest here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can follow him on Twitter at Rep. David R. Lewis. What's the R for?
Ray.
Is this your, and I should know, this is an embarrassing question for me to ask on the fly. This is your ninth term in the House?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Lucky guess out of me. Let's stick with gerrymandering and redistricting and the partisan nature of it. And I want to ask you about the quote that everybody has asked you about, or the quote that perhaps you were most quoted for saying, which comes from 2016. There was a special session in which you all redrew new congressional maps. And the quote I'm going to pull here is, this is attributable to you from the House floor. He said, "So I drew this map to help foster what I think is better for the country. I propose that we draw the maps to give a partisan advantage to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats, because I do not believe it's possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats," close quote. So I think a couple of interesting things on that quote. One, there have been numerous legal challenges. One of them, I think, is before the U.S. Supreme Court later this month. It stems from that.
That's correct.
Do you regret saying that?
I think it's important to understand and place that quote into context. First of all, if you look at the total transcript of the conversation about redistricting, less than 20% of the total debate even focused on politics. I think it's also fair to point out that I was tasked in 2 weeks to redraw congressional districts because the Supreme Court had found a racial bias in the original drawing of the map, a process that normally takes 6 months, I was asked to do in 2 weeks. When I said it was not possible to draw a map that was 11-2, that was actually a part of a statement which I should have finished by saying, and follow all of the criteria, because we'd adopted criteria, trying not to split counties, trying not to split precincts. If politics was the only criteria I had followed, I believe I could have given Republicans a chance in 12 out of the 13, but it was not the only criteria. It was only one criteria. And so what I regret is due largely to exhaustion, I simply didn't finish my statement, which is following the criteria of not splitting towns, of not splitting counties, of not splitting precincts, of keeping, you know, so people know who their representative are, then the 10-3 map, which was the outcome of the prior year's election, was one of the goals that we had. But it's important to understand that we had that goal in part because we had been sued and were defending ourselves for a racial gerrymander. And another thing that I get quoted on all the time, and I see myself in clips, is I made the statement that said when we use politics, it is to gain partisan advantage. Well, I said that because in the opinion that the court had issued, they said that we had used politics in lieu of race, or that race was a code, or politics was a code word, when we actually said politics, we were actually talking about race. I was just getting on the record that to the extent that we used politics, it was for political purposes and not as a code word for race. I was trying to clarify the record. Again, that maybe I could have given more context at the time that I made that statement, but certainly the intent was to make clear that race was not that in my opinion and in my intent and in my goal in drafting policy, I do not think race and politics are the same thing. And the court implied that we had tried to use those interchangeably. So I was making clear that since politics was one of the factors that we used, not the dominant factor, but one of the factors that we used, that it was politics for politics' sake, not politics in place of race.
So, quickly, just to review, congressional maps were established coming out of the 2010 census in 2011. Those maps for the 13 U.S. House seats from North Carolina, and again, my caveat is always just stop me at any point if I'm spewing out stuff that's incorrect. New maps were established in 2011 for the state's 13 U.S. House seats. Those were eventually struck down for being illegal racial gerrymanders. That was the court ruling. So you all came back in and you drew them in 2016. You established new maps. We had a special election in 2016, and there since have been legal challenges to those. And what was unprecedented, what's happened in the courtroom since, is that a panel of three federal judges ruled those maps illegal, not on racial guidelines, but on partisan guidelines. So before the Supreme Court later this month is, I think, two cases, one pertaining to a Republican-drawn map in North Carolina and one pertaining to a Democratic-drawn map in Maryland. Is there such thing as too much partisanship? I mean, the backdrop to this whole thing is gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering, has been legal in our country for 200-plus years. We heard about the Wisconsin case. We heard a lot about that last year. The Supreme Court didn't do anything with it. They have to do something with this because there's been a ruling, that my understanding of it, is they have to do a little bit more with this because we've had this three-judge panel rule. Is there such thing truly as too much partisanship? And what can the Supreme Court do here?
I think there can definitely be too much politics. I think that if politics is your sole driving criteria, your sole driving factor that motivates every decision that you make, and you are using that rationale and it unduly upsets the balance of the other criteria, then probably there's a role for the courts there. But it's important to understand that politics was only one of the criteria that was used in drawing our maps. You know, when I talk to my constituents in Harnett County, the easiest thing in the world for me to say is we need to take politics out of drawing maps and we need to figure out some other different way to do it. But the bottom line is, if you follow all the rules, if you try to keep counties together, if you try not to divide precincts, if you try to keep cities together, still, because you've one person, one vote, you've got to draw a line somewhere. And all I do is tell people honestly that I'm going to follow the law and I'm going to apply the criteria. But if in the end I have to draw a line here or there, and drawing it here benefits a potential Republican candidate and drawing it there hurts a potential Republican candidate, I'm not going to lie and say I arbitrarily made the choice. You know, partisanship, we often believe that word applies exclusively to the political parties, but it's really an expression of one's internal biases. And if you are claiming that you don't have a bias one way or the other in drawing maps, the bias doesn't have to be that you want to favor the Democrats or favor the Republicans. You know, one of the proposals that we have up here now tasks the central staff with drawing the map, and the General Assembly just votes on it. Well, again, the lines have to be drawn somewhere, and it may very well be that Representative Jones, I just made up that name, wasn't very nice to the bill drafting staff that's being tasked with this. Well, that's a bias. That's a partisanship, perhaps against Representative Jones, that they may not even be cognizant of. All I've tried to tell people is we followed the rules. We followed traditional redistricting principles. And one of those principles traditionally has been politics. Politics was never the at no time did politics win out over the other guidelines that, and the other criteria that we use, like one person, one vote, not splitting counties. I mean, if I challenge anybody listening to your podcast to pull up our map and look at it, and what you're going to see is out of 100 counties in this state, only 13 of the counties are divided at all. 80.
Those would be the urban counties, yeah.
Right.
For the most part.
Right. And
87 of them are not.
87 counties are whole, so people know who their representative are. And within the counties that are divided, only 12 precincts out of the thousands this state has, only 12 precincts are even split. So our maps make sense. You know, the word gerrymander itself came because they tried to mix Governor
Elbridge
Gerry with the image of a salamander. Well, look at our maps. You'll see whole counties and whole precincts. I don't know about the Maryland case. Frankly, between everything I have to do, I haven't really had time to do much research on it. But I think a reasonable person looking at the map will say, you know, this map doesn't have squiggly lines. It doesn't have a corridor that runs down I-85, which is, you know, North Carolina is sort of infamous for that. This map makes sense. And I'm very optimistic that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to give us a fair shake, and I think they'll reverse this lower court ruling.
How you're not an attorney by trade. We hear the word landmark sometimes with major decisions. Does this have the potential to be a landmark case?
Yes. If the Supreme Court of the United States issues a ruling that the use of politics is inappropriate in drawing districts, then every district, be it a county commissioner district, be it a congressional district, be it a state legislative district, anybody that doesn't like any district, if it's a ward in your local town, can go to court and challenge it. So it is literally opening up every single district based on the way we elect people in the United States of America. In a district system, it opens up those up for challenges. And I have a great deal of respect for the United States Supreme Court. I'm not sure they want to do that.
If this goes the other way, if they overrule, as you said, you're just optimistic or hopeful that they are, they overrule the three-judge panel, is there any part of you, as you think about, you know, the next 10, 20, or 30 years, that worries about gerrymandering continuing to a level or just being further enhanced with technology and with other tools? Do you think it could be a point of no return?
Well, again, I think it's important to understand that what the Supreme Court is ruling on this time is, are people denied the right of expression or the right of, they call it speech, are their First Amendment rights to express themselves somehow impaired when politics are used? And what I think you can go back and look, you know, you mentioned, we talked about earlier in this interview, the constitutional amendments that were on the ballot. And I think if you look at voter ID, largely that's kind of breaks along partisan lines. A hardcore Democrat has strong reservations against voter ID. A hardcore Republican usually strongly favors voter ID. And voter ID passed in over 80 of our counties. It is entirely possible to draw a correlation to the more urban an area is, the more likely they are to have more progressive, more Democratic-leaning feelings. The majority, you know, I hear all the time people say North Carolina is a purple state. You know, we sort of not really Democrat, not really Republican. Well, the truth is, I would say we are a Republican state. We're a red state. If you look at a map, 80 of our counties approve the voter ID. Now, the pockets of blue that we have are not only deep blue, because they're strongly Democratic, but there's a lot of people that live there, and those people have a voice. But if I am a Republican living in Wake County, then if you follow the logic of the people that keep filing these lawsuits, then I should be able to file a lawsuit because there aren't any elected Republicans left in Wake County. If I'm a Republican in Mecklenburg County, I ought to be able to file a lawsuit because there is no elected Republican member of the House in Mecklenburg County. And what gets me, and just sort of like a body blow every time, is when we were drawing these congressional districts, several of the Democrats said, well, you just shouldn't draw for a partisan end. You know, we used to draw the districts to where there'd be 7 Democrats and 6 Republicans. Well, that is a partisan end. They've always had that goal.
It just may not be a maximum, or may not be...
True. What the plaintiffs accuse me of, frankly, is placing as many Democrats in as few districts as I can do. What I accuse them of is dispersing as many Democrats into Republican areas in order to elect more Democrats as they possibly can. The best way to do it is to do what we've done, which is to establish criteria. Let's keep counties together. Let's keep precincts together. When we can, let's keep municipalities together. The reason I say when we can, you know, Raleigh takes up a lot of precincts, mm-hmm. and Raleigh itself has multiple seats. You can't keep a city whole because of the population thing every time. But if you can, you should. You know, I had to make some tough choices in our latest state house map draw. The town of Anger, which is a great, great little community, that I enjoy getting to work with. I had to take that out for population reasons of the rest of Harnett County, and that was a hard choice to make, but it had to be done. So we felt like splitting Anger proper, because people of Anger know who they are, they identify as citizens of Anger, putting that in its entirety in a district would be better than picking and choosing somewhere else.
David Lewis on the podcast here, WNC Politics Podcast. We've chatted more policy than perhaps I intended when I came in, but as you've alluded to with these things, I think that redistricting and the judicial conversation, while the rhetoric can get ramped up quickly, they're layered discussions. There's a lot of nuance to these things, and I think a lot of the listeners recognize that. I want to transition from policy to some personal. For folks that are listening, for folks that listen to you, if they listen into a session or if they're in the chamber, they will notice that you have a stutter. And I wanted to ask you about that. It's not something, candidly, that we've ever talked about before. But this is, you're not a CPA. You're not the manager of a restaurant or something. Your job is to speak in public, at least in part. So I guess tell me a little bit about your speech impediment.
Growing up, I had a different kind of speech impediment in that a lot of my consonant sounds weren't right. I would try to say L for Lewis and it would come out as a W. And so I took a lot of speech therapy to correct that. And I think in part I overcorrected it and learned to put, as my teacher used to joke about, put the emphasis on the wrong syllable from time to time. And but frankly, stuttering or runs in my family. Both, it's a hereditary thing. Both blocking, which is what I have, which is where you just can't get the next syllable out, or you put the stress on it so much that it doesn't sound right. And then there's the repetitive stuttering where you repeat yourself. And fortunately, I don't have that, at least not very often. So it is a natural thing. I've taken speech therapy most of my life. I can tell you that just like anybody else that deals pretty much with anything, you know, when I am more tired, when I am more stressed, then I am less able to manage it. When I can sort of, if you've ever been on a long distance phone call or a cell phone call where you had an unusual connection where you could hear yourself talk, that kind of delayed repeating of yourself actually helps a stutterer pace themselves. I have, and from time to time, wear a speakeasy device, which was developed at East Carolina University, which creates that kind of auditory feedback. Mm. But truthfully, in a setting like you and I are in now, which is a quiet office where we're not raising our voices, I'm able to actually monitor the tone and the pace at which I speak. Where I struggle is when I need to get loud or when I need to interrupt someone who's speaking. Or stutterers are very good at being able to substitute words that they have difficulty saying. If there's a word that I have difficulty saying, I will simply choose a word that means the same thing. But where that doesn't work, and one of the things that you will hardly ever see me do in public is to read a list of names. Because when you're reading someone's name, there is no substitute. Jeff Tiberi is Jeff Tiberi. There's no way to get around that. And, you know, there are all kinds of little things that I do. You know, there are just certain words that are harder for me, certain sounds that are harder for me. I mean, I have a son named Henry, and I represent Harnett County. But H's, especially if I'm having to raise my voice or having to do whatever, H's are sometimes hard for me to say. So there are some times that I'll say I represent beautiful Harnett County because I can make that flow without the emphasis being on the H. So it's just something that I've learned to live with. And about the only time it bothers me is sometimes I'll call somebody on the phone and I'll block for a minute and I can't quite get out what I'm saying. And the person say, "Oh, hey, David, how are you?" Because they know it's me, you know. And that's kind of embarrassing. And frankly, most time I keep it controlled pretty well. But it's not always been that way. When I first came to the house in the early 2000s, when I was speaking to the mic, I would hold the mic right up to my mouth because I would try to create a situation like you and I are in now in which I was talking rather soft. And if I talk soft, I don't put quite the emphasis and the power and the punch to my words, which makes me speak smoother. But that's not always possible in politics.
So on the spectrum that I'm going to create right here for us, between the ends are going to be tolerance and embraced, and in the middle is, I guess, acceptance. If you were to talk about where you are, this is a pretty personal question, but where you are with this challenge that you've had for a long time, do you tolerate it? Do you accept it? Or have you embraced it? I mean, is it, where does it fall for you?
Somewhere between the tolerate schedule. I mean, I wish I didn't have this, but I do, and I'm 48 years old, and I've learned that I'm always going to have this, and I don't feel it particularly limits what I do. Occasionally there's some folks that you know, political enemies will sometimes make fun of me. I need to lose weight, and I know that. You know, I stutter sometimes, so a lot of times the lowest common denominator is what people choose to attack. But I'd say certainly the people that I serve with don't do that, and I'm very thankful that the people of Harnett County haven't let that they haven't felt that my service to them has been impaired just because my speech sometimes is.
Appreciate you pulling back the curtain on something that is very much a personal component of your life. Before we conclude here, I'm going to throw some at you, rapid fire. You can go as long as you want on them, but the idea here is to be as quick as possible. North Carolina's 3rd Congressional District is open right now. A special election will take place. Filing closed last week. There are 17 Republicans in the race. You don't live in the district, but if you did, and if you were voting in the primary, which of those 17 Republicans would you vote for?
I think there's some excellent choices. I don't believe in trying to dodge a question, but I serve with several of those guys, and frankly, I've served with Ms. Nix in the Republican Party capacity. I don't really feel qualified because I don't live in that area. I don't know the needs of that area. I don't really feel like I'm qualified to answer that question.
What has been your most significant mistake as a lawmaker?
My most significant mistake as a lawmaker is trying to do too much and sacrifice time away from my family when I was needed. I have felt like I needed to see things through up here. One of the biggest regrets that I'll live with until I die is in 2014, my father was very ill, and I actually had to have a staff person check him in the hospital because I was presenting a bill up here. And he died a month later, and I'll never forgive myself for that. I should have been there with him. And I truly believe that I make a difference up here, but I have sacrificed a lot in my personal life, in my professional life, and sometimes those things come back to haunt me.
In North Carolina politics, the person who is sincerely and most regularly trying to find middle ground.
That may be the hardest question I've ever been asked. There are so many good people who are all doing the very best they can to represent the people back home. But, you know, this is a very diverse state, and
just to be clear, there aren't a lot of people you're thinking about right now. You're looking for one.
Yeah. I really can't answer that, Jeff, you know, because there are so many people who I think are often willing, you know, there are a lot of things that that Representative Darrin Jackson and I would do together, but you know, he has a duty not only to his constituent but to his caucus. I have a duty to mine and my caucus as well. I think that my particular talents are being able to help as many different sides come together on policy issues. I don't know that it's necessarily an overriding effort to just get everybody to get along. You know, I have, unfortunately, we live in a world where if anybody takes a position that is different from the base or the core of their party, they're usually savaged over. You know, there's a lot, you know, I admire so much, you know, a lot of the, for instance, several of the members that I serve with on the Democratic side who are school choice people, you know, they are just viciously attacked for not towing the party line. Some of the people on my side that I serve with who maybe think we've cut taxes enough, you know, they're viciously savaged on my side for not, you know, because that's not the mainstream or the main line of how we think about things. So I really wish I could give you a name of somebody who's constantly seeking compromise or to bring folks together. I think there are a handful of us that do work hard to bring folks together, but it's oftentimes to give somebody 50% of what they're trying to get, and in exchange for them supporting the 50% that I want to get. So
I'm going to get blasted if I don't ask you at least one Medicaid question. So Medicaid expansion in North Carolina in 2019. A, B, or C? A, advances out of the House, dies in the Senate. B, governor vetoes some sort of Medicaid expansion. It's not good enough for him, and you all don't override it. C, Medicaid expansion is enacted and becomes law here in North Carolina in 2019. A, B, or C?
Closest scenario is B.
I gave you an easy one. You could put it on the governor, huh?
I mean, I'm just... Well, no. I think there are some... There is not a member up here who does not want to help those people who need health insurance find a way to get it. But there are a lot of different ideas. I do not see a vote to purely expand Medicaid, which many other states have done, or the manner that they have done it. I don't see that ever coming about. But there's a lot of good minds, a lot of creative people who are working to try to find how can we help those people get health coverage without, you know, what some states have found out is they expand Medicaid and people that are currently on employer health plans, the employer drops a plan because it's cheaper for them to let the, you know, the person be on the expanded Medicaid. And what's often said is, oh, it's, you know, it's so much federal money, and it is a lot of federal money, but it's also 600, you know, I think the state part would be $600 million a year. And out of a $22 billion budget, I know that's a lot of big numbers, but that's a sizable amount of money. So
roughly. Yeah. About 3% of the budget?
That sounds right. You know, I have supported, you know, the one thing that doesn't get reported often or even talked about often is Medicaid's grown every year. There's more people on, you know, even though our economy has done well and more people have jobs, there's also just more, there's just more people in North Carolina. So Medicaid grows every year. It just hasn't grown by this one big chunk that everybody has been fixated on.
Last one. You celebrated your birthday last week. You are 48 years young. What is your go-to birthday dessert?
Go-to birthday dessert, I really like Oreo cake, my wife calls it dirt cake. Really, really enjoy that. But more importantly, she usually makes me spaghetti every year on my birthday, which is her spaghetti is my favorite food. So
meat sauce?
Oh, absolutely.
Nine-term House lawmaker from Harnett County, Representative David Lewis. Thank you for joining us for this extended conversation here on the podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for the hard work that you do in providing coverage of the state legislature for the people of the state.
Thanks, as always, for tuning in to the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can leave us a rating or review wherever it is that you get this program, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. Don't forget to stay up to date with whatever it is that is going on at your legislature throughout the week at our website, WUNC.org. For Representative David Lewis, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your weekend. We'll talk to you soon.